Please open your Bibles to the book of Jude. The book of Jude. We noticed this text in our study last week, beginning in verse 5 through about verse 16 or so. And we want to notice it again tonight and again, well, next Sunday night. And so as we look at this passage, we note that Jude parallels 2 Peter as he's addressing some of the same things and dealing with them essentially in the same kind of way. As both books are primarily talking about those who are false teachers, those who teach things wrong, and we note that Jude as well as Peter tells them how that needs to be looked upon. And so I want to begin the reading in Jude verse 5. In Jude verse 5, he said, "Now I desire to put you in remembrance, though you know all things once for all, that the Lord, having saved a people out of the land of Egypt, afterward destroyed them that believed not, and angels that kept not their own principality, but left their proper habitation, he hath kept in everlasting bonds under darkness unto the judgment of the great day. Even as Sodom and Gomorrah, the cities about them, having in like manner with these given themselves over to fornication, and gone after strange flesh, and set forth as an example, suffering the punishment of eternal life. Yet in like manner, these also in their dreamings defile the flesh, and set it not dominion, and rail at dignities. But Michael the archangel, when contending with the devil, he disputed about the body of Moses, does not bring against him a railing judgment, but said, The Lord rebuke thee. But these rail at whatsoever things they know not, and what they understand naturally, like the creatures without reason. In these things are they destroyed. Woe unto them, for they went after the way of Cain, and ran riotously in the error of Balaam for hire, and perished in the gainsaying of Korah. These are they who are hidden rocks in your love feast when they feast with you, shepherds that without fear feed themselves, clouds without water, carried along by winds, autumn trees without fruit, twice dead, plucked up by the roots, wild waves of the sea foaming out their own shame, wandering stars for whom the blackness of darkness hath been reserved forever. And to these also Enoch, the seventh from Adam, prophesied, saying, Behold, the Lord come with 10,000 of his holy ones to execute judgment upon all and to convict all the ungodly of all their works of ungodliness, which they have ungodly wrought, and of all the hard things which ungodly sinners have spoken against him. These are murmurers, complainers, walking after their lust, with their mouth speaketh great swelling words, showing respect to persons for the sake of advantage." Now, as we read this text, and you can parallel that specifically, if you'd like, to 2 Peter chapter 2, and note that the Apostle Peter talking about the same thing. And the characteristics that are given in Jude's expressions, filthy dreamers, how that they had turned the grace of God into lasciviousness. They had despised dominion. They had practiced ungodly things. They had no respect for God's will. The sensual things, they'd walked in their own lust. And then as we talk about Balaam, they ran riotously in the error of Balaam for hire. These are characterized as those who spoke great swelling words. Now I want to notice the parallel of the Old Testament text that follows along with this from Numbers, actually chapter 21 through 25. If you're taking notes, write that down and read Numbers chapter 21 through 25. I was tempted just to read the whole thing tonight, but I won't do that. But I would like for you to read it because it gives us a backdrop against which the things that are discussed in our study from the book of Jude are cast. Now, in Numbers, more specifically, in chapter 22, we read about a king named Balak, the son of Zippor, and he saw how that the Israelites had destroyed the Amorites. Now, you can read about that back over in chapter 21. But the irony of that is, he sees them coming, and he's threatened, he's sore afraid, verse 3 tells us, because they were so many. And Moab was distressed because of the children of Israel, verse 3 tells us. And Moab said unto the elders of Midian, now will this multitude lick up all that is around us, as the ox licketh up the grass of the field. And Balak, the son of Zippor, was king of Moab at the time. And he sent messengers unto Balaam, the son of Beor, to Pethor, which is by the river, to the land of the children of his people, to call him, saying, behold, there is a people come out of Egypt. Behold, they cover the face of the earth, and they abide over against me. Now let's pause just there. What we want to note is, here's the setting. Moab is afraid. He is afraid of the Israelites, the king of Moab, Balak, because the Israelites have conquered other places, including the Amorites, and he sees them coming toward him, and he's afraid because they are so great in number. And he sends for Balaam. And his desire for Balaam was, as we see in verse 6, come now therefore, I pray thee, curse me this people, for they are too mighty for me. Peradventure I shall prevail, that we may smite them, and that I may drive them out of the land. For I know that he whom thou blessed is blessed, and he whom thou cursest is cursed. Now that sets the stage for the things that are about to take place the next few chapters. Now in verse 7, what we want to note is that the elders of Moab and the elders of Midian departed with the rewards of divination. In other words, they're taking money and whatever else they can take to old Balaam to try to get him to come and to curse these people. Balaam, however, makes inquiry of God whether or not he should go with these men. And God told him in verse 12, thou shalt not go with them. Anybody in the audience this evening that did not understand that? God said, thou shalt not go with them. That's pretty simple. I'm persuaded that Balaam didn't have any trouble understanding what God said. He said, thou shalt not curse the people, for they are blessed. Now then, question asked, question answered should be done, right? But the text tells us in verse 13 that Balaam rose up in the morning and said unto the princes of Balak, get you into your land, for Jehovah refuseth to give me leave to go with you. And the princes of Moab rose up and they went to Balak and said, Balaam refuseth to come. Well, it wasn't exactly that Balaam refused to come. God told him, don't go. Period. End of story. But Balak sent yet again princes more and more honorable than they. And they came to Balaam and said unto him, thus saith Balak, the son of Zippor, let nothing, I pray thee, hinder thee from coming, for I will promote thee unto very great honor, and whatsoever thou sayest unto me, I will do. Come therefore, and I pray thee, curse me this people. And he said again in verse 18, if Balak would give me his house full of silver and gold, I cannot go beyond the word of Jehovah, my God, to do more or less. Now, I want to suggest to you that when we look at that, we look at Balaam and say, he's a pretty good old boy, wasn't he? He's got a good understanding of what God said when God said, thou shalt not go with them. He's got that. But now we find that more honorable princes are sent to invite him to come, and more benefit is offered to him. More money, if you please, whatever it takes to get you to come. And in verse 20, or verse 19, now therefore I pray you, tarry ye here also this night, that I may know what Jehovah will speak unto me more. I would suggest to you that here is where Balaam messed up. God has already been asked the question. He's already answered it. No, don't go with them. And now we find on this second inquiry, Balak says, wait right here. Let me go ask again. Does he expect the answer to change? Does he expect the will of God to change? Is anything really any different? Keep in mind that old Balak's very insistent. He doesn't want to be conquered by this people. And he wants Balaam to come and curse this people. He's under the impression that whatever Balaam says, that's what will take place. And so he wants them to come. I want to suggest to you that Balaam's first weakness He had more than one. But his first weakness becomes evident right here. He begins to negotiate. Now, negotiating with wrong things is as old as man. You take that all the way back to the Garden of Eden. When we read in Genesis chapter 2, God said unto Adam, "There is a tree in the midst of the garden which thou mayest not eat." How fundamental is that to us? And then when the devil began to approach Eve, he said, "Is there a tree in the garden of which God said thou mayest not freely eat?" And Eve correctly said, "Yes, there's one. God said there's a tree in the midst of the garden that we're not allowed to eat of it and not even to touch it." Now, did she understand what God had said? She even stated the consequences. "You see, if we do, we'll die." God had made it very clear that in the day that thou eatest thereof, thou shalt surely die. We're not supposed to eat of it. We're not supposed to even touch it. What's Eve doing talking with the devil? Why is she even discussing this with the devil? She understood what God said. Adam understood what God said. But she began to negotiate with the devil. And I tell you what, brethren, anytime you begin to negotiate and rationalize with the devil, it's not going to work out for your benefit. Never. 100% failure rate. Yep, that won't work. And you can read in 1 Kings chapter 13 of another good illustration of that. We read of a young prophet who was went to cry out against the altars that King Jeroboam had set up. And you recall how that Jeroboam wanted this young prophet to come and dine with him. He said, "Can't do it. God told me that I cannot eat or drink along the way, and I can't go home the same way that I came." Did the young prophet understand what God had said, just like Eve did? Oh yeah, not a real problem. Did Balaam understand what God said in this passage? Well, yeah, it's not a problem understanding what God said. God made it very plain. But then we find that there was an old prophet in the land, and he sent word to the young prophet to come and dine with me. And the young prophet explained again, "I cannot eat or drink along the way. I can't go home the same way that I came." And the old prophet said, "Yes, but God told me that you could." And the text tells us that he lied to him. You think Satan's above lying? You think he's above deceiving you, trying to get you to believe something that's not true, that'll destroy your soul? No, he's not above it. Now, when we read about Balaam in this text, what we want to note is that old Balak has put before him some things that cause him to want to reconsider. And sometimes we do that. We want to rationalize and reconsider. You know, how can I make this where that I can do what I want to do and do what God wants me to do at the same time? And sometimes there's a conflict. And sometimes we walk headlong right into it, like Balaam did. Now it's interesting to note that Balaam, when he approached God a second time, the text tells us in verse 20, "And God came to Balaam at night and said unto him, If the men are come to call thee, rise up, go with them. But only the word which I speak unto thee, that shall thou do." Has God really changed his mind on this? Sometimes when we study this, somebody says, "Why didn't God just tell him the same thing he'd already told him?" Because he had already told him. Once should be enough. I recall when our children were small, and perhaps you've done this too. We had a big dog. And we would go for a walk with the dog almost every day. Same place, everything. And if you've ever walked a dog, you know what dogs do. The dog had to stop. And I would stop with the dog, and Donna and the girls would keep on walking. And when the dog was ready to go, I would run, and the dog and I would go and catch up. And one of my daughters said, "I want to take the dog. I want to hold the dog. I want to have the leash so I can walk the dog." And I said, "No. No. Next day. No. 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 Not good idea. Dog too big. You can't hold the dog." Okay. Well, you know, after a few times of asking, I finally just handed over the leash. Bad idea. The dog came to his place, and what did he do? He stopped. And when he was through and ready to go, what did he do? Like he always did, he ran to catch up. And my daughter had her hand through the hole in the leash, and she couldn't let go. He jerked her off her feet and she drug on the asphalt for just a little bit. It was awful. It was much worse than I anticipated that it would be. But when we look at this passage, did Balaam really have to ask a second time? Or did he know the answer? And when God said, okay, go ahead, had God changed his mind? Or was there a lesson to be learned here? Now, when we look in this text, it tells us in verse 21 that Balaam rose up in the morning and saddled his ass and went to the princess of Moab. And God's anger was kindled because he went. And the angel of Jehovah placed himself in the way for an adversary against him. And now he was riding upon an ass, and his two servants were with him. And the ass saw the angel of Jehovah standing in the way with his sword drawn in his hand. And the ass turned out of the way and went into the field. And Balaam smote the ass to turn her into the way. Then the angel of Jehovah stood in a narrow path between the vineyards, a wall being on this side and a wall on that. And the ass saw the angel of Jehovah, and she thrust herself into the wall and crushed Balaam's foot against the wall. And he smote her again. And the angel of Jehovah went further and stood in a narrow place where there was no way to turn either to the right hand or to the left. The ass saw the angel of Jehovah, and she lay down under Balaam. And Balaam's anger was kindled, and he smote the ass with his staff. And Jehovah opened the mouth of the ass, and she said unto Balaam, what have I done unto thee, that thou hast smitten me these three times? And Balaam said unto the ass, because thou hast mocked me. Now get the picture. Balaam's talking to his donkey. He's negotiating, if you please, with his donkey. And if you'll notice in the text, it says, why have you smitten me these three times? Balaam said, because thou hast mocked me. I would that there were a sword in my hand, for now I'd kill thee. And the ass said unto Balaam, am I not thine ass, upon whom thou hast ridden all thy life, a life long unto this day? Was I ever wont to do so unto thee? And he said, no. Now what do we know about the ass? Been faithful and loyal all these many years. Verse 31, then Jehovah opened the eyes of Balaam, and he saw the angel of Jehovah standing in the way, and the sword drawn in his hand, and he bowed his head and fell on his face. And when the angel of Jehovah said unto him, wherefore hast thou smitten thine ass these three times? Behold, I am come forth for an adversary, because thy way is perverse before me. And the ass saw me and turned aside before thee these three times. Unless she had turned aside from me, surely now I had even slain thee and saved her alive. And Balaam said unto the angel of Jehovah, I have sinned, for I knew not that thou stoodest in the way against me. Now therefore, if it displeases thee, I will get me back again. Wait a minute. Didn't he know that it was displeasing? Because God told him on the very beginning, don't go. And the angel of Jehovah said unto Balaam, go with these men, but only do the word that I speak unto thee, that thou shalt speak. And Balaam went with the princess of Balak. God told him already, don't go. Now he's going, is conditioned upon only saying the things that God says to say. Now you see, we're into the book of Numbers fairly well. I'm not going to read all of it. You think I am, but I'm not going to read all of it. But what I want us to see is the circumstance that Balaam is in. He's placed himself in an awful position. But what Balaam does is he is limited only to the things that God will let him do. And when Balak takes him up on a high visible point to show him all these people of Israel, we know that old Balaam reminds Balak, I can't do anything except what God said. And in verse 7, he took up a parable from Aelis, chapter 23 now, verse 7. He took up a parable and said, from Aram hath Balak brought me. The king of Moab from the mountains of the east, come curse me, Jacob, and come defy Israel. How shall I curse whom God hath not cursed? And how shall I defy whom God hath not defied? For from the top of the rocks I see him, and from the hills I beheld him. Lo, it is a people that dwelleth alone and shall not be reckoned among the nations. Who can count the dust of Jacob or number the fourth part of Israel? Let me die the death of the righteous and let my last end be like his. Oh, Balak's upset. What have you done to me? I'm trying to pay you to curse these people, and all you have done is you've blessed them altogether. Balaam said, I can't do anything more or less than what God said. Sounds admirable, doesn't it? Oh, but we've got all kinds of problems that are perking up here. Balaam is getting in trouble because he didn't listen to God when God said, don't go. Isn't that simple? Don't go. Now you'll note, beginning in verse 18, that Balaam took up another parable. And lo and behold, it turned out to be a blessing unto the people of God. And in verse 25, Balak said unto Balaam, neither curse them at all, nor bless them. But Balaam answered and said, I told you, all that I can do is what Jehovah's told me. That's all I can do. Sounds very honorable, doesn't it? But then as you begin reading in the 24th chapter, when Balaam saw that it pleased Jehovah to bless Israel, he went not, and at the other time, or as at the other times, to meet the enchantments, but he set his face toward the wilderness. And Balaam lifted up his eyes, and he saw Israel dwelling according to the tribes, and the Spirit of God came upon him, and he spoke a parable. And the parable that he spoke this time is rather interesting. But again, Balak was angry. In verse 10 of chapter 24, it says, and Balak's anger was kindled against Balaam, and he smote his hands together, and Balak said to Balaam, I call thee to curse mine enemies, and behold, thou hast altogether blessed them. These three times. And like he said before in verse 13, he said, if Balak would give me his house full of silver and gold, I can't go beyond what God has said. Sounds wonderful, doesn't it? Oh, but why is he there? Why is he carrying on such negotiations with this man? And as you continue into the 24th chapter, we find that Balaam reveals that Moab is going to be smitten. He reveals that Edom is going to be smitten. Just like he looked upon Amalek and took up a parable that Amalek was going to be smitten, the Kenite was going to be smitten, and all of those who were the enemies of God's people were going to be smitten. And then in verse 25 of chapter 24, it says, and Balaam rose up and went and returned to his place, and Balak also went his way. Now here's where it really gets interesting in this Old Testament text. In chapter 25, verse 25 of chapter 24, we simply see that Balaam went home. But in chapter 25, verse 1, Israel abode in Shittim, and the people began to play the harlot with the daughters of Moab. For they called the people unto to sacrifice unto their gods, and the people did eat and bowed down to their gods, and Israel joined himself unto Baal Peor, that is, an idol. And the anger of Jehovah was kindled against Israel, and Jehovah said unto Moses, take all the chiefs of the people and hang them up unto Jehovah before the sun, that the fierce anger of Jehovah may turn away from Israel. And Moses said to the judges of Israel, slay ye every one his men that have joined themselves unto Baal Peor. And then in verses 6 through 7, we see the why of that. We know that the children of Israel have gone in not only to the Moabitess women, but the Midianitess women. And in verse 7, it tells us, when Phinehas, the son of Eleazar, the son of Aaron, the priest, saw it, he rose up from the midst of the congregation, and he took a spear in his hand, and he went after the man of Israel under the pavilion, and thrust both of them, that is, the man and the woman, through their bodies. So the plague was stayed from the children of Israel, and those that died by the plague were 24,000. Now, I want to stop there in our text, because all of that could have been avoided. The whole thing could have been avoided if Balaam had just listened to what God said. God said, the answer to your question about going with these men, the answer is no, don't go. But knowing what God said, he's determined to go. Now in our text, we find that some details are filled in between Numbers chapter 24 and Numbers chapter 25. In our text of the book of Jude, we learn what it is that Balaam has done. And as we turn further into the book of Numbers even, to chapter 31, you'll note in verse 16, there the text tells us, behold, these caused the children of Israel through the counsel of Balaam to commit trespass against Jehovah in the matter of Peor, and so the plague among the congregation, or so the plague was among the congregation of Jehovah. Balaam did something. What did Balaam do? Well, we don't see that in Numbers 24 and 25. But we learn from these other passages that Balaam gave counsel. You want to curse these people? Here's what you do. You send your women in among them. You get them to commit fornication with these women, and then God will curse them. And that's what we learn as we see in Numbers chapter 31. And as you turn in your New Testament to 2 Peter chapter 2, we said there were some parallels in this, and drop down to verse 15 of 2 Peter chapter 2. There the text tells us, forsaking the right way, they went astray, having followed the way of Balaam, the son of Beor, who loved the hire for wrongdoing. But he was rebuked for his own transgressions. A dumb ass spake with man's voice and stayed the madness of the prophet. What do we learn about Balaam? He told Balak how to get God to curse these people. You get these people to do wrong things. And when they do wrong things, God then will curse them. I said to someone a moment ago, I can't get out of the book of Revelation. In chapter 2, verse 14, we read there in the letter to those in Pergamum, the text tells us, but I have a few things against thee, because thou hast some that hold the teaching of Balaam, and taught Balak to cast a stumbling block before the children of Israel, to eat things sacrificed to idols, and to commit fornication. Now there's our answer. Between Numbers chapter 24 and Numbers chapter 25, what did Balaam do? He gave instruction to the king how to get God to curse these people to cause them to commit fornication. Now, let's kind of ball all this up together and learn some lessons from it. We note that Balaam wanted to see what God would say. Said he couldn't do anything more, couldn't do anything less. And we learn from the text that he said, well, you know, I can't go beyond what God said, which makes it appear that he has a love for the truth. But did he? Did he? We've seen him wishy-washy on this thing. Let me go ask God again and see what God will say more. He's negotiating to accomplish the very thing that he wants to do. I want to suggest to you the very same thing, that when we do not have a love for the truth, God will allow us to do what you want to. Won't he? He's not going to put a bar in front of you and keep you from doing the thing that you want to do. You have the free will of choice, and you will do what you want to do. And so as we read in 2 Thessalonians chapter 2, beginning in verse 10, your Bible says, and with all deceit of unrighteousness for them that perish, because they receive not the love of the truth, that they might be saved. And for this cause God sendeth them a working of error, that they should believe a lie, that they all might be judged, who believe not the truth, but have pleasure in unrighteousness. God answered Balaam's question. Question asked and answered. If he loved the truth, he's got the answer. No reason to go back a second and third time and say, what do you want me to do? God already told him, made it very clear what he wanted him to do. But what we learn in this passage is that when he didn't believe the truth, didn't love the truth, he wants it to be tweaked just enough to let him do what he wants to. And I would suggest this to you, brethren, that when we tweak the truth, we don't have the truth anymore. They were trying to tweak it in Galatians chapter 2, and Paul said, you can't do that. To whom we gave place in the way of subjection, no, not for an hour, that the truth of the gospel remain with you. Can't do that. Not even for a little while. In Matthew the 15th chapter, we read there earlier in previous studies about the Pharisees and how that they are called hypocrites because with their mouth, with their lips, they honored him. But he said, your heart is far from me. It's not your desire to do what I tell you to do. It's your desire to subject yourselves to the precepts of men. Now, if you want to simply do what God wants you to do, the answer to that's simple, friend. You buy the truth and you sell it not. Not at any price. Balaam was willing to negotiate so that he could have it his way. Doesn't work. Didn't work then. Don't work today. Isn't that simple for us? And so what we want to learn from this is that Balaam messed up by going back to see what God would tell him more or less. Now those hypocrites that we were reading about in Matthew chapter 15, we see more about them in Matthew chapter 23, where they're rebuked over and over. Woe unto them, hypocrites. And it just goes from there. And bad matters become worst. And as we noted, in Numbers chapter 25 and in Revelation chapter 2 and in Numbers chapter 31. Balaam taught Balak how to cast a stumbling block before these people. Let me ask you, folks. We know that we are created for good works, which God afore prepared. We can read that in Ephesians chapter 2. Did Balaam know what God wanted him to do? We've answered it already. Yes, he knew. But he wants to negotiate a more acceptable answer. The wisdom writer said that there's a way that seems right unto a man, but the end thereof is death. God had made his will known, but Balaam wanted to do something else. Now Jude tells us why. He loved money. The higher, that which was offered to him, seemed to have a great appeal. Let me ask you another question. Sometimes when we're negotiating these things, don't we want to see what we can accomplish? And think that what we're doing is really a good thing. Now question, how do you know when what you're doing is really a good thing? God has afore prepared. You can read it in the Bible. But you see, when David went to recover the Ark of the Covenant that had been taken to the house of Abinadab, he brought it back the same way that the Philistines had taken it, and he had trouble. You remember Uzzah put up his hand, steadied the Ark, and we're often critical of Uzzah. But one of the things we want to note is who Uzzah was. He was one of the sons of Abinadab. And where had that Ark of the Covenant been kept for 20 years? In the house of Abinadab. I would suggest to you that Uzzah's over familiarity with the Ark of the Covenant created the temptation to reach up and touch it. Even though we might say his motives were honorable, he don't want it to fall to the ground. But only the priest were to touch it. Uzzah was not a priest. And David began to inform himself. And he said, because we didn't take it like God told us, that's why this happened. And he appointed the priests to cleanse themselves and prepare themselves so that they could carry the Ark of the Covenant as God had instructed. You see, we can't begin to substitute and tweak and alter and mess with what God has said. It gets us into trouble, don't it? We can't do that. And as you'll note further concerning Balaam, the text tells us that he cast a stumbling block before the people, and he caused them, in doing so, to commit fornication with these women of the Moabites and the Midianites. Their moral standard had lowered. Well, we know that under the law of Moses, they had been instructed not to commit adultery. They had been instructed regarding what their level of morality was to be. And those in Corinth, in 1 Corinthians 6, they had lived that life. You recall, in times gone by, beginning in verse 9 through verse 11 of chapter 6, and in verse 18 of that text, he addresses very pointedly, flee fornication. Don't do that. And what do we define these people doing? Negotiating with the devil so that they can have these relationships with these foreign women. And do we not find sometimes ourselves doing the same thing when it comes to morals? We say, you know, well, it's really all right to dance, provided it's properly chaperoned. And after all, there may be some drinking going on, but it's all right as long as we don't get drunk. And then folks say, well, it's all right to go to the public swimming hole, you see, because everybody else is wearing these bathing suits and modesty's just kind of been accepted as long as it's a modest bathing suit. You see, I would suggest to you that, frankly, I doubt that one today in this modern world even exists. But as we think on those lines, we want to know, well, what does the Bible say then about the marriage relationship? I was talking with someone recently about the, quote, sanctity of marriage. Didn't understand what the word sanctity meant. I said, well, the honor. The honor of marriage. It's an honorable relationship because that's what God designed. But he placed his restrictions upon it. And he said that a man is to depart from mother and father and to join himself to his wife, and the two are to be one flesh, and that is to be for the rest of his life, and there's only one exception. And that was the exception that the Pharisees asked about in Matthew chapter 19 when they wanted to know, is it all right or is it lawful for a man to divorce his wife for just any cause?
And Jesus said, have you not read that he who made them in the beginning made them male and female and said, for this cause shall a man leave father and mother and shall cleave unto his wife. And the two shall be one flesh. What therefore God has joined together, let not man put asunder. Is there anybody in the audience that don't understand that? I'm persuaded they understood his answer. The answer to their question, is it lawful for a man to divorce his wife for any cause, is no. And then they begin to rationalize like Balaam did. Well, what about what Moses said over here in Deuteronomy 24? And it's not our purpose to debate what Moses said, but let me assure you, he did not say what they attributed him to saying. Jesus said, because of the hardness of your heart, Moses suffered you to put away your wives, but from the beginning it hath not been so. It hath not been so. He said, I say unto you that whosoever shall put away his wife except for fornication and shall marry another commits adultery. And he that marries her that's put away doth commit adultery. Now, is there anybody in the house don't understand that? Go back to their question. Is it lawful for a man to divorce his wife for just any cause? Well, the answer is still no, isn't it? It's still no. Only one cause. The cause is fornication. That cause being present allows one who's innocent to divorce the one who's guilty and may marry again without sin. What about the one who's guilty? Well, he can't marry again. Don't we see that? But, you know, we begin to reason and rationalize about that, and we say, well, you know, Paul said that it's better to marry than to burn. Paul said that to avoid fornication, let every man have his own wife and every woman have her own husband. But see, it doesn't say anything about you having somebody else's wife or husband, does it? Can't do that. But we begin to reason and rationalize, and then we come to the conclusion, well, you know, God didn't really deal with a specific case that's like mine. And so mine becomes the exception. No, the question's real simple. Is it lawful for a man to put away his wife for just any cause? And the answer's still no. Now, if that's not the cause and you've divorced, then you don't have a scriptural right to be remarried. Do we not see that? All the reasoning and the rational and doing exactly the same thing that Balaam did. Trying to find a way to do the very thing that God said not to do. And as we noted, there are many who pay lip service. But that's all that it is. Like Balaam did. I can't do anything more or less than what God said. There are many gospel preachers who preach error on this subject. Who would say, I can't say anything more or less than what God said. What, do you preach on marriage? Do you preach on divorce? Do you preach on remarriage? It's addressed in Scripture. And if you don't preach on it, then you're not preaching what God says. And if you're not preaching what God says, you're making the same efforts that old Balaam made. Now, why did Balaam do that? I want to call your attention back again to some passages we've already read. In Deuteronomy chapter 22 and in verse 7, there the text tells us, and the elders of Moab and the elders of Midian departed with the rewards of divination in their hand. What do they have? Money! We're going to pay you to do this. You see further evidence of that in verse 16. And they came to Balaam and said unto him, thus saith Balak the son of Zippor, let nothing, I pray thee, hinder thee from coming. I will promote thee unto very great honor, and whatsoever thou sayest unto me, I will do. Come therefore, I pray thee, curse me this people. Name your price. Well, Balaam wants to go. And you see why. And that's why Jude said he loved the hire to do that. He won't love money. And that got him into trouble. Do you know there are those who preach wrong things for the very same reason? In Galatians chapter 1, there were Judaizing teachers who were telling the people that you have to be circumcised in order to be saved. And they were telling them that because that was more popular. You'll read of some that are very specific in 2 Peter chapter 2, beginning in verse 1, who did what they did because of money. And yet we find that, yeah, money's important. We are to lay by in store upon the first day of the week and all of that. And we can be critical of those Jews who robbed God in the book of Malachi because they did not lay by in store. Money, our love for it, to be specific, can create all kinds of problems, don't it? In fact, Paul said that in 1 Timothy chapter 6, that the love of money is the root of all kinds of evil. Well, who was Balaam? He was a prophet, and Balaam's responsibility was to serve the Lord. But he didn't see himself in that light. Old Balaam saw himself as a servant of himself. And consequently, what we learn is he becomes an example. As we can read in 1 Corinthians chapter 10, where the writer tells us, don't do what they did. Neither let us commit fornication, as some of them committed, and fell in the wilderness. And we can read there what some have described as a discrepancy in the numbers. 24,000, 25,000, it doesn't make any difference. Thousands of them died because of the sin that old Balaam led them to commit. Don't we see that? Now, Jude makes it very pointed. Woe unto them, for they ran righteously in the error of Balaam for hire. For hire. This is the point we made last time regarding Cain. That the consequences of that is not just temporal. It's forever and ever. Old Balaam and Cain, right along with that rich man of Luke chapter 16, they're going to have to be punished from that day forward. The day they die, now and forever, it's not ever going to stop. Everlasting punishment where the fire doesn't cease. It's not quenched forever and ever. Now that's the sad light of old Balaam. Sad end. Now one of the things that I want to conclude our study with is look at how he started. Here's Balaam, a prophet. And his desire was, I want to see what God would say. Is that desirable? Should we want to see what God has to say about any subject? Well, yes, that's desirable. And then his attitude toward what God said as far as what he expressed is, I can't do anything more or less. So here we have a man who is a prophet, who is a worshiping prophet, who is interested in what God said. He's going to make inquiry, and he affirms, I can't do anything more or less. But then he went back to see what God would say that might be different. And the text tells us, in chapter 24 and 25, really nothing of what Balaam does to lead these people to commit fornication. The New Testament tells us that. He taught Balak how to get this accomplished. Balaam was not a nice guy. Not in the end. He ended up a liar. He ended up a hypocrite, a false teacher. He led multitudes to their death. He led multitudes to commit idolatry and fornication and eternal doom. You see, the error of Balaam was quite a big thing. Mentioned just briefly here in the book of Jude. Just a very brief little blip. So what do we learn? It's not enough just to love the truth. Hypocrisy has to be avoided. We can cast a stumbling block before God's people by calling upon them to compromise. And my friends, we can become greedy for the reward just like Balaam did, and the love of money got him into trouble. We can lead multitudes to eternal damnation. There are consequences to this, and the error of Balaam. You want to name your son or daughter after Balaam? Well, perhaps no more than Cain, or no more than Jezebel. And so as we read concerning these examples in history, they are written for our admonition, upon whom the ends of the ages are come, and they're cited in the New Testament for us, so that we don't mess up like they did. Valuable lessons. Sometimes we learn to tell the story of the donkey of Balaam talking to him, and that's all it is. It's just a story. But we miss the lesson about Balaam. He messed up, and the lesson is taught in the New Testament about Balaam. Don't do what he did. Maybe I'm talking to somebody tonight who might need to obey the gospel. My friend, do it now. There will be a time when opportunities such as this won't be presented. This is not just a simple time that we come together out of habit or ritual. It's just as real what we're doing tonight as it was in the first century times. Studying from the very same book, the very same lessons that were taught over and over and over and over to God's people. Let's learn the lessons. Obey the gospel tonight while time and opportunity is yours. Maybe you've obeyed the gospel and you're not living righteously. Keep in mind, Balaam was a prophet. He started out as a good fellow, but he didn't wind up that way. And you see, the eternal judgment is dependent upon where you are when you wind up, isn't it? We can help you to make your life right. Make it known. While together we stand and while we sing the song.